science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Always good, Sting. Always good, Sting. All right. We're talking about, well, first off, we're going to plug a TV show, aren't we?
We are indeed, yes.
How old is this TV show?
This is old. This is 1978 we're talking here.
Okay.
So well before, you know.
Well before you were around, shall we say.
So I was sitting there in the Power Cut last night thinking, as I often do on a Tuesday night, what the hell can I talk about on Wednesday? Because, as you know, Lillian, I do leave things to the last minute occasionally.
Not at all.
But then I thought, gosh, why don't I plug my favourite science television program of all time?
Of
all time. And that means it is the greatest science TV show of all time.
How many times have you watched it?
Oh, more than a few.
Wow.
More than a few. But this is a program called Connections, and it's hosted by a guy by the name of James Burke, who, if you watch it, you'll see wonderful 70s fashion, the sort of the trouser suit or the khaki jacket and all that sort of stuff. But that besides, this is an utterly, utterly fascinating TV program that talks about the connections between essentially everything, all of the scientific advances that we've made today and where they came from, basically, and how the link works and how if any sort of link in that chain was broken, then, you know, we wouldn't have the things that we do today. So. And the reason why I was thinking of this in the Power Cut was episode one of this starts off with a big power cut that occurred in New York City in 1965 and the surrounding sort of northeast. So there were 30 million people affected by this, and it occurred right in the middle of rush hour. So you've got all the trains underground and everything. You've got everyone on the lifts and stuff like that, and everything stopped. And so he goes into this in great detail, how it occurred and what the consequences of this were. You know, nobody died, I don't think, but an awful lot of people were inconvenienced. And, you know, imagine being stuck under the ground and overnight in the bloody metro system in New York. Wouldn't be particularly pleasant. And he then sort of asked the question, well, what would have happened if the power never came back on? What would you do? And he sort of took it from there and said, right, well, you know, the first thing you'd probably do is get out of town, because, you know, there's millions of people all probably wanting to do the same thing.
Where to, though?
Yeah, where to? Exactly, where to? So you get in your car and you drive, and then you can only drive until you run out of petrol, because there won't be any petrol, because everyone's looking for petrol as well. And so then you stop somewhere out in the country and you might end up on a farm, and you think, oh, you know, well, I could start my life here, but in order to do that, I've got to know how to plant things. So in order to do that, I've got to know how to use a plough. You know, and probably, you know, 99,000,000% of the world's population has never used a plough in their life. And then he took that and said, right, well, you know, this is the way that technology started, was ancient Egypt and the plough, and managing to, you know, plough fields and being able to plant much more rapidly than they'd be able to do that at that stage. And it's these fascinating, fascinating connections that he comes up with. And I remember watching this when I was a kid and thinking, yeah, shit, this, you know, I'd love to do that sort of stuff. I think that's so cool. It was just so, so interesting. So
you're saying it's not a fictional story?
It's a person
taking you through what would happen, what could happen, and then how that links to history.
Yeah, yeah. So, and you know, delving back all of the years ago in history and seeing how the things that we use today basically come from these really, really unlikely sources. Like, for example, so the Normans used stirrups. So when they invaded England, so they used stirrups on their horses. And that's a direct link to modern telecommunications.
What?
Don't ask me how. You've got to watch it. The link between Greek astrology and the production line. Castle fortifications in the Middle Ages and movie projectors. All of these things, that's just absolutely brilliant. So if anybody...
How many episodes?
So there's 10 episodes.
Okay.
And he's sort of making the point that we're really sort of prisoners of technology now. And that, remember, this was like 40 years ago, actually. And all the points he makes are still, well, they're true more so now, I guess, that we truly are prisoners of our own technology. You know, do you know how your iPhone works? I haven't got a bloody clue, you know. All of our modern day things that we absolutely rely on, and if they go fut, like they did last night in the power cut, we're absolutely screwed.
I wasn't able to contact people this morning because my phone was flat.
Yeah.
Until I was able to get to a place that I could charge it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, and that's sort of the point that he's making, that unlike the olden days, I guess, now nobody is intelligent enough to know everything. Whereas... back in the day, you know, back in sort of Middle Ages or something, you probably could. You had polymaths in those days that could speak bloody nine languages and knew all their science, and, you know, because they studied all that stuff, but there wasn't so much to know in those days.
But also you had to know those things.
Oh, yes, indeed, yeah. Yeah, somebody had to, and you know, individual people could. But now...
Also now we don't need to store as much information personally because we have... iPhones that take notes.
Yes, you have the internet, but the internet's bloody useless without power, isn't it? Totally. So we really are in a technology trap. And
so what do we do? Read more books?
Well, we just keep going and going and going, I guess, until something happens, I suppose. You
and
know?
Then we actually all can't do anything.
Well, you know, somebody once said that they don't know what the Third World War, what weapons the Third World War will be fought with, but they know that the Fourth World War will be fought with sticks and stones, which, you know, kind of makes sense. So, you know,
because
because humanity is going to get obliterated at some stage, or, you know, all of the knowledge and stuff
and
like that.
And starting again.
And then you've got to go back and start again. So I really... really, really would strongly recommend anybody who's got a vague interest in science plus history, go on the web and search for James Burke with an E and connections.
Okay.
And they are there, even though you couldn't play it this morning for some reason.
Yeah, that's okay. I'll look for it. I'll find it.
So if you go to archive.org and search in there have a look, and really you'll be hooked from episode one.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Lisa is joining us in studio in time to talk about proteins.
Bonjour, Lisa.
Wasn't expecting that. Ça va? Ça va très bien, toi?
Ooh.
There we go.
Too far.
I'm lost.
I have two French roommates at the moment, so I'm getting my fair share of French. So.
Well, yes, okay, next week. You can come back with a few more words.
Doing all of dear science in French.
C'est pas possible. No, no, no.
Oh, that was really
good. Okay,
so proteins.
So proteins. Okay, so not so much. It is kind of proteins, but again,
specific.
This has got a history bent to it, which I think is quite nice. So these some researchers in Italy have developed a technique whereby they can take old documents or parchments or pieces of art or something like that, and they can analyse the surface of them. And quite simply, all that they do is put a little sort of sticky thing on the surface, and when they lift it off, it lifts off any sort of charged molecules that are there. And most probably those things are proteins, okay? And proteins are associated with particular viruses, bacteria, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So if you can find which particular proteins are on your particular work of art or whatever, you can possibly get a bit of an idea of what was going on at the time when that piece of art was created. And I think that's really, really cool. It's kind of obvious in hindsight, but...
What sort of stuff would you be able to find?
Well, okay, so the examples that they had... So Mikhail Bulgakov, who, famous Russian writer of the early 20th century, so he was busy dying of some kidney disease while he was writing his final magnum opus, and they got the manuscript, the actual manuscript of that, and they analysed it, and they found traces of morphine and morphine metabolites on that. And that was completed about 4 weeks, I think, before he died. And he was obviously in a great deal of pain, so he was on morphine for that pain. So they were finding traces of morphine on this particular manuscript, which is kind of cool.
Wow. So you can see actually the environment.
Yes, the environment.
People are in.
I think that's brilliant. And the very famous one, these are Italian researchers, and so there was a very, very famous apparently outbreak of the plague in Milan in sort of the 1600s, and about half the population of Milan died. But for some reason, the people who were left wanted to keep a really, really good record of how many people died and who they were, etc. So there's a lot of sort of handwritten records dating from that time. And so they've gone through these. And again, with their little technique, obviously they've found bacteria that are associated with the plague, but they've also, are associated with the plague, but they've also found proteins associated with anthrax as well. So that might have killed more than a few people. And they've found proteins from food, so from rice and from carrots and stuff like that.
Oh, so you can also have insight on what people were eating.
Yeah,
When you say proteins of the plague, is that dangerous?
No, it's not dangerous. They're just a protein. It's not a virus or anything like that. So you're all okay there. But it's just these proteins that are associated with it. By themselves, they're harmless, okay? So they get that. And then they found a lot of mice proteins as well. So, and they sort of figure that, okay, so the mice are obviously sort of scrounging for food, and, you know, they had their manuscripts all over the place and everything, and the mice are running all over
around
and stuff. And that's, you know, that's really cool.
This is, yeah, very cool.
Mm, and the other one was Chekhov, so Anton Chekhov, Cherry Orchard and all that sort of stuff. And he had a bloodstained shirt on the day that he died, apparently. And so they analysed this drop of blood and they found proteins associated with TB in there. And it had always been thought that Chekhov had died of TB, and now it's basically confirmed.
Wow.
So, you know,
I was just going to ask, brilliant. This is cool to know, but what's it going to be used for? That sort of thing.
Absolutely conclusive proof of people's
theories that relate to these documents.
Yeah.
But could you use it to, like you said, like, oh, we found proteins of rice and carrots and that kind of stuff. So could you really use that as a tool to recreate the environment, like the wider environment?
I think
around
you,
people.
You probably could. The one thing that you're going to have to be really, really sure of, though, is that the documents have been, or whatever it is, they haven't had everybody and their dog sort of going through them over the intervening years, sort of thing. So it'd be nice if they were sort of kept away in a like dark cupboard or something like that, so that
you could do
not
that with
getting contaminated. And
you could do
stuff.
That with archives, like general sort of archives.
Yes,
and
yeah.
With every single document that has ever been kept.
I think it's brilliant. I think they've made a real niche for themselves. These people. I think it's absolutely fascinating. And so there's sort of, you know, scientific archaeology, really. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot more work in this field, I think.
Yeah, somebody did really nice. Just text in saying, how many semen stains have they found on all this stuff? Might be a good place to end. Moving on to the next topic.
A
renewable source of fuel.
Well,
possibly.
That's the holy grail, isn't it? We need that. And I've spoken about this sort of stuff more than once on this show, the fact that the fossil fuels are running out and we need solar power and we need it yesterday, sort of thing. So there's a whole truckload of people all around the world who are busy investigating solar-powered machines, etc., etc. And there's some folk in Singapore who are looking at splitting water. Okay, so water we can potentially use as a fuel. Because water can be split into its elements, hydrogen and oxygen. And then when you recombine hydrogen and oxygen, you get truckloads of energy out. Now, problem with that is you've got to split the water into hydrogen and oxygen first. And that requires more energy, essentially, than you get back from recombining them. Okay? Unless the energy that you use is essentially free. In other words, solar energy.
Okay, so you're saying that you would use solar energy to split the water.
There you go.
And
yep.
then...
Yep.
Recombine them and get a whole lot of energy.
Yes. So that's sort of the holy grail for a whole lot of people now. So, you know, it's absolutely a no-brainer that mankind's going to go solar. And so one of the problems with and what they're doing is seawater. So seawater is basically limitless, okay? That's never going to run out.
Is it?
Yeah, because it's going up the clouds.
I mean, it's not
going to
dry.
No, we're not going to do that. Because what product do we make when we combine hydrogen and oxygen, folks?
Don't ask us. You know
water.
We don't know.
Here we go, water. Yes.
I do know that one.
Okay. So hydrogen and oxygen give you water. So basically you're splitting water apart and then you're putting it back together and making water again.
Okay.
Okay. Plus you're getting truckloads of energy out of it. That's the beauty of it.
Okay.
Now the problem with doing this with seawater, now pure water is not a problem, but with seawater you've got a whole lot of sodium chloride in seawater. And as any good chemist will tell you, if you try and split seawater, then you're going to get chlorine gas formed as well, or you certainly can do. And that's a real problem with doing this sort of stuff with seawater. But they have developed this new catalyst that seemingly doesn't oxidize the chloride to chlorine, but it just splits the water into hydrogen and oxygen nice and cleanly. It leaves the chloride in solution, and then you can recombine it, and away you go. So, no, go.
Oh, well, I have I have a question.
Okay.
If we have extensive amounts of seawater, right?
We do.
But we may have limited fresh water. In some places in the world, there is limited fresh water.
There is, yes.
Is there a way of using this to then create more fresh water if we're taking...
No. Well, you could make fresh water. Yeah, you could, I guess. But there's probably more efficient ways of making fresh water. Like in the Middle East, for example, they've got desalination plants. Where they basically take seawater and they force it through a membrane and that takes out the salt. And so on the other side of that, they get fresh water. So
okay.
it's as simple as that.
So using this other process that you're talking about now would be more steps and
yes,
more complicated.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah. Okay. So that wouldn't be a way of doing
so
it.
So this is solely for new energy?
Yes, yeah. And, you know, it's good. It's just in its sort of formative stages and stuff. But from the sound of it, if they can scale it up and everything, it might be really, really good for planet Earth. So,
do we run into patent concerns? Like, whoever's, you know, done this, do they get...
They've patented it. So, you know,
is it going to cost a lot for the world to... if we start to do this and we use this as our...
Ah, that's the beauty of this. Thank you for reminding me. So the way that this differs from other similar sorts of systems is that the catalysts that are used in other systems are made up of things like platinum and iridium. And I'm sure you've heard of platinum, and mm-hmm. that's expensive as all heck, so it's more expensive than gold. Iridium's more expensive than platinum, et cetera, et cetera. So therefore, and they are very, very limited. There's not very much platinum, there's not very much iridium on the planet. So what you want are catalysts that can do the same sort of thing, but operate with simple things that you can dig out of the ground. And so they've got this one to operate with cobalt and iron, and there's truckloads of both of them. So
brilliant.
This is, you know, this is really, really nice. It works on all levels, so hopefully they can scale it up and, you know, watch this space. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
All right. Let's wrap it up then. Thank you, Alan.
Not a problem. And we didn't have time to talk about the silent vibrators, which I know you desperately wanted to talk about.
I actually really wanted to talk about it. But we do have to wrap up. We're very over time. But yes, thank you for announcing that there are now in development or already made, already available.
It's hard to tell from what they were saying in the Herald, actually.
Okay.
But, you know.
Check it out in the Herald. Silent vibrators on the market soon. We all know how loud the vibrators can be.
Yeah.
Moving on. Thank you, Alan. See you next week.
That was Dear Science.